Next, then, on our agenda is item J. That's a report by the Commission on the proposals by the Strategic Evaluation Committee. And before we hear public comment, I want to say a few things about this historic report. And that is, as you know, when I became chief approximately 18 months ago, our branch faced alarming budget cutbacks due to the fiscal crisis. We had experienced some before, but at that time, we didn't know how long it would go, and we still don't really, and we didn't know its depth. So at that point, the Judicial Council and the Administrative Office of the Courts was also the subject of a great deal of criticism during that transition. And those criticisms had to be addressed immediately. My goal from the outset was to establish a fresh approach to governance, one that's based on what we do here now, I believe, transparency, accountability, and oversight, and self-assessment, and communication. So again, soon after I became Chief Justice, I surveyed the judges. Sorry, Glenn County, but that was a survey that I asked for them to tell me anonymously, and if they chose, what was wrong with governance and what was wrong with how they perceived the Judicial Council doing its job, and whether or not there were any recommendations. And so I, like many of you, I received the responses. I read them. I shared them with the appropriate committees, and the next steps really started to form, and that was we needed more facts. As a council, we needed more facts to proceed. As far as the criticism of the AOC was concerned, I needed an objective body to study the agency, and a body that understood what we do and how we do it. Really, it was a dilemma whether to hire someone to do this or to use our expertise. And as you know, I fell on the side of expertise evaluating the AOC. And so in March 2011, I appointed the Strategic Evaluation Committee in order to conduct an in-depth review of the AOC because I believed I and the JC needed the report as a tool to how we would move forward with efficiency and transparency and what was clearly becoming diminishing resources. The committee worked independently, tirelessly, without staff, collected volumes of information, reached out, tried to contact every entity or person who wanted to contribute or speak to this historic report, and 55 weeks later, in spite of their day jobs, they presented a final report, approximately 150 recommendations to the council. We're taking this report seriously. It's important. It's our first self-assessment of how we've operated and how we should move forward. As you know, I appointed Judicial Counsel Judge Wachob and Judge McCabe, the chair and vice chair of the SEC committee, as well as Judge Cheryl Ellsworth, to ensure follow-up and to give us background and to help us move forward with this report and its recommendations. In June, counsel accepted the report, and thereafter we had public comment on the website. We've had two rounds of deliberation, I think, that I can fairly say about the SEC, that from the survey, that from the public comment. Well, really a third now, and that is the synthesis of those comments by E&P, which we'll hear about today. And before we begin hearing that and before we hear public comment, I again want to thank several different groups, and of course, first, the SEC committee for the remarkable work that's presented to us. None of us will ever underestimate or forget what you've done for the court, the branch, and surveying and bringing this information that helps us move forward. I also want to thank E&P because I know in your 11 meetings that you described yesterday that probably 9 of them were regarding the SEC and the synthesis of the comments and making sure that this could be presented to council in a timely, intelligent, coherent fashion that we could act on. I also want to thank, in addition to Judge Wachob, Judge McCabe, Judge Ellsworth, someone who isn't here today, California Judges Association President David Rubin, for having CGA participate in their own lengthy discussions and evaluations of the SEC report. And also, finally, to the AOC employees, the dedicated public servants who responded to this survey, who helped bring it forward with ideas about how we can operate better and more efficiently to serve the courts, to serve the public, to serve the Judicial Council. And I know that we have many challenges ahead of us, but this is moving us in the right direction, and we will continue to move in the right direction with open-mindedness, deliberation, and civility. And with that in mind, then, I'd like to call up our first speaker to comment on item J, and that is the Honorable Carol Corrigan, Associate Justice, California Supreme Court. Welcome, Justice Corrigan.
Good morning. Madam Chief Justice and members of the council, it's a pleasure to see so many happy and familiar faces. I have the privilege of having been appointed to the bench in 1987. Inexplicably, then, the calendar seems to dictate that I have been a judge for 25 years. Now, I don't claim that that quarter of a century has conferred upon me any encyclopedic wisdom, but it has given me a certain sense of perspective. And it seems to me that perspective is greatly needed as we move forward to lead the branch together. The California judiciary is one of the best in the world, and yet it is no secret that we, like the state and the people we serve, are facing some substantial challenges. History tells us that when big challenges arise, people become anxious and sometimes angry. And we know that in times such as those, the people need reasonable, sound, wise leaders in whom they can repose confidence. It is, of course, the responsibility of the Chief Justice and the Council, but more broadly, all the judges of California, to provide that leadership. The process the Chief Justice has initiated has done its work diligently, independently, and with broad input. Everybody in the branch had a chance to voice their concerns and their frustrations. Everybody had a chance to make recommendations and offer suggestions. Now, that process hasn't been easy, and it certainly hasn't been fun. And as with all difficult and important undertakings, it has not been without some controversy and some acrimony. Reasonable minds may certainly differ on many things, but now you have a candid and clear report on branch governance. And while reasonable minds may differ, that informs us why we need to look at those recommendations with analysis and review. But broadly, we have looked backwards, and we have identified a number of substantial failings and some things that must be changed. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, however, that it is now time to stop looking backwards and start looking forwards to determine how to make constructive progress. And this is where the concept of perspective comes in. The report rightfully faults some past decision-making as lacking in deliberation and cooperation. Fair enough. But let's not repeat those shortcomings. Let's make sure that we do deliberate about the findings and recommendations and do so as part of an ongoing dialogue. One major theme of the report is the need for openness, transparency, and cooperation. Let us remember that each of those laudable goals is a two-way street. There may be some who insist that you listen to them and them alone, that only their views have merit. Some may act in the glow of self-interest. Some may speak in the heat of intemperate zeal and dissatisfaction. And this is, of course, their right. But I suggest that today we should agree to turn a page. We can learn from our history, but we cannot change it. And while we cannot change our history, we must and can responsibly guide our future. Now, we can continue to look backward, to focus on blame, and to nurse our grudges. Sometimes it seems that that's what we do best. We can talk at each other rather than speak with each other. Or we can take a deep breath, remember that we are professionals entrusted with substantial responsibilities, and resolve to work together as partners rather than fight as adversaries, to reason rather than demand, and to discern rather than dictate. The report you have received makes a number of suggestions. But perhaps our greatest challenge is to work together to see that mutual cooperation and confidence is restored and built upon. This is a collective and mutual process. That is not to say that we will not sometimes disagree. Bright, insightful people of goodwill do on occasion, and sometimes on more than occasional instances, disagree. But often the best ideas flow from their ongoing discussions about their divergent views. recognizing all of this, we should commit ourselves to be what we have been trained to be: decisive, informed, deliberate, and smart decision makers who honestly work together to find solutions in the spirit of cooperation. As we turn this page, we have a new chief. We have a new council. We will have a restructured administrative office under a new leader. Much remains, and new challenges will, of course, arise. We can meet them if all parts of the branch watch closely, share openly, discuss collegially, and work together to serve the people of California from whom, we should be mindful, our authority derives. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Justice Corrigan. Next, we'll hear from the Honorable Brenda Harbin-Fort, Judge, Superior Court of California, County of Alameda. Welcome.
Morning, all. Madam Chief Justice, thank you very much. Members of the Judicial Council, to our interim Administrative Director, and to our newly appointed Administrative Director, welcome, Steve. To all of you, again, I'm Judge Brenda Harbin-Fort from the Alameda County Superior Court, and I do thank you so very much for this opportunity to address you today. I will incorporate by reference my written remarks, and I won't repeat them here. I will, however, raise some issues with you that will make some of you uncomfortable. And I do it in the spirit, the same spirit that Justice Corrigan talked about, so that we discuss, we debate, and we consider opposing and contrary views. A judge, in trying to decide whether and how to intercede in negotiations regarding a plea agreement in a criminal case involving two African-American defendants, alluded to the Ku Klux Klan, making a remark to the effect that he guessed that the only thing that would make the defendants plead was for him to come out in a white sheet and a pointy hat. A judge ordered a small claims plaintiff to have no contact with three women and to stay away from a credit union without complying with any of the procedural requirements for the issuance of a restraining order and without affording that person who was the subject of the order notice and an opportunity to be heard. In a domestic violence case, after the petitioner testified to certain incidents, the judge stated that she was concerned about the throwing of rocks and spitting and stated, usually that is the kind of behavior I see in Middle Eastern clients. The judge added, if the declaration says he drags me around the house by the hair, it's almost always a Hispanic client. In a family law case, the judge ordered a change of custody at a hearing without prior notice to the parties and failed to rule on the party's request for accommodation under the ADA. A judge remanded a pro per defendant for failing to obey the judge's order to be quiet without following any of the procedures required for contempt, and then on his own motion and off the record increased the defendant's bail. During a jury trial with a difficult pro per criminal defendant, the judge made a number of statements about the credibility of that defendant, suggesting that the defendant was misrepresenting things in the court. During a traffic calendar, the judge announced that the judge wanted to meet with the police officers privately. When one of the traffic defendants expressed concern about that private meeting, the defendant was called a demeaning name by the judge. During a telephone appearance, the mic was open. The judge and the opposing counsel didn't know that this pro per incarcerated inmate was there, and the judge made statements that suggested that the inmate's case had no merit. During a criminal trial, the judge summarily precluded the defense from presenting surrebuttal evidence, improperly ruling that the defense had no such right and displayed impatience toward the defense attorney when the attorney objected. In a sentencing, after negotiated pleas, the judge failed to afford the crime victim, the opportunity to present a victim impact statement in person or in open court. Now, these things did not happen in my home state of Mississippi. These things did not occur some long time ago. These things happened right here, and although I will say about my home state of Mississippi, there was certainly a secret society of robe-wearing individuals who, through threats and intimidation, and public ridicule sought to deny justice to African Americans and others who were unfortunate enough to come into the court system. These events that I described happened here in California, and they happened fairly recently, for they were reported in the 2011 report of the Commission on Judicial Performance. And so now we have an opportunity to look at our court system and to make some changes and to make some decisions about where we go and how we help judges to maneuver through, to negotiate through those sticky and important issues that we must all face. And that is why the approach to change now must be a deliberate approach, and I applaud the efforts to do further study before simply adopting and incorporating all of those references. Our members of the public and public trust and confidence reports have told us that that procedural fairness in the courts is more important than the outcome itself. And we now, with respect to one of those recommendations, are saying, let us now abandon the public trust and confidence aspect, that division, that section, because there's no funding for it. Can we look and see if there is something else that we can do to ensure public trust and confidence in our system? Can we make sure and make a public commitment to preserving access and fairness? Can we commit to increasing diversity on the bench? Can we commit to being that role model of public service that we are now telling the administrative office of the courts to adopt, to be responsive, to be servants? Can we remember that our customers are members of the public? Let us strive. It is not a suggestion. So I want to suggest that we are being a barista if we try to serve the public. Let us understand those are our customers. That is why we are there. We are there to ensure that justice is in our court systems. We are there to preserve fairness in our courts. I thank you, Madam Chief Justice, for these remarks.
Thank you, Judge Harbin-Forte. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Terry Cannon, Chair, State Bar of California, Council on Access and Fairness. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the Judicial Council, AOC staff, and guests. I'm Terry Cannon. I'm a lawyer and the chair this year of the State Bar Council on Access and Fairness, and in my day job, I'm executive director of the Western Association of Schools and Colleges. If you're not aware of what the Council on Access and Fairness of the State Bar does, I'll tell you just quickly. It was established in 2006 to consolidate the work of the State Bar in the areas of diversity and to carry out the State Bar's work to increase the diversity in the legal profession under one umbrella entity. Its purposes are to eliminate bias in and enhance the diversity of the legal profession. It acts as a think tank, creating initiatives along the pipeline into the legal profession and the judiciary and law practice. It has 25 members from the bench and from all sectors of the legal profession, including private practice, corporate law departments, government agencies, nonprofit legal aid, and education. And it addresses all kinds of diversity, racial, ethnic, gender, LGBT, disability, and age. And we did submit a letter on July 16th, which I believe you've all seen, so I won't repeat all of what's said in that letter, but I do want to emphasize a few things to the Council. We share with the Council the goals of providing equal access to the courts, having judicial officers and staff that are responsive to the diverse cultural backgrounds of court users, which Judge Brenda just addressed, and building a judiciary that's representative of California's population. As you know, this is your goal number one, the Judicial Council strategic plan adopted in 2006, and this aligns directly with the work that we've been doing, especially through our Committee on the Judiciary. We have much work to do together to achieve these goals. Just a few statistics that I'm sure you're all familiar with. The state of California has a population that's 60% racial ethnic minority. We have only 20% of our lawyers who are racial ethnic minority background, and only 27% of the judiciary. The state has more than half women, and we have only 40% women lawyers and 31% members of the bench who are women. The progress that has been made in the last 15 years toward achieving our shared goals has been brought about largely through the efforts of the State Bar, the Judicial Council, and the Administrative Office of the Courts, working collaboratively in many different ways, especially the work of the Advisory Committee on Access and Fairness of the AOC, which has carried out several critical projects, including bias training for Jenny, resource guides and materials on various aspects of diversity, and the statewide judicial summits, one of which we just got the final report from a few days ago. We were very concerned about the impact of the recommendations in the report, in the SEC report, when we read it, and we're really pleased to hear the tone that you, Chief, and Justice Corrigan have set and the deliberative effort that you're making to consider the impact of each of the recommendations that was made in that comprehensive report. And we're very appreciative of the serious budget crisis that you're facing. And so we all understand the challenge that you have before you and the budgetary constraints. But we were concerned that the report didn't seem to give much consideration to diversity, access, and fairness or prioritize in any way its recommendations around that. And we're concerned that if some of the recommendations are adopted, they would undermine the efforts that the Judicial Council and the AOC have made in order to improve the climate and the diversity of the bench. Particularly, you'll see in our letter 7.4, 12, and 20 of the recommendations that would may result in the elimination of the Advisory Committee on Access and Fairness and could result in the reclassification of staff positions from lawyer to non-lawyer or the elimination of positions altogether. So we urge you not to adopt those recommendations without careful consideration of the court's own goals and priorities and the needs of an impact on court users. The future confidence and trust of the people of California in our court system depend on the actions that you take on this report. The experience of those who pass through the courts and their perception of the fairness of the system depend on having a diverse judiciary and judges and court personnel who are aware of and sensitive to the very diverse backgrounds of the persons who appear before them. So we ask that you retain a distinct entity that's dedicated to achieving your goal number one and continue to support lawyer staffing of that entity, which we believe is crucial to the expertise that's needed to carry out the initiatives that support your goal number one. And we thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you, Ms. Cannon. That concludes our public comment. We can then begin to address item J with Justice Miller.
Thank you, Chief, and good morning. Good morning. As the Chief indicated earlier, in March of 2011, the Chief Justice created and appointed the Strategic Evaluation Committee. The SEC was charged with conducting an in-depth review of the AOC, its organizational structure, the services it's provided, the various functions it played, its operations, and the role it played within the courts and the Judicial Council. Again, as we all know, the SEC completed its work and submitted their report to the Chief Justice on May 25, 2012. They made 151 recommendations, a significant number. Four dealt with the Judicial Council, its role, and its oversight responsibility. A number dealt with the structure and organization of the AOC, and then many involved in evaluation of the individual divisions and their actions. I know that this has been said many times, but I think it's important, and again, I want to personally and publicly commend the SEC committee members for their incredible efforts, their hard work, their time, and the just significant sacrifice that they have made. As all of us know, and especially the members of Executive and Planning, as having lived with this now for far less than the SEC members had, This is a very, very valuable tool in our quest as a judicial council and as a Chief Justice in making improvements through this important process of self-assessment. The Judicial Council at its June meeting accepted the report and assigned the report to Executive and Planning for its further review and consideration. You all specifically directed E&P to evaluate each recommendation, to prioritize each recommendation, and to create timelines for implementation, and then bring those back to the council for your independent consideration and, we hope, approval. In addition, the Judicial Council directed staff to post the SEC report on its public webpage. It's been accessible since, I believe, that evening to the public. We also were directed to encourage public comments for a period of 30 days, and we received a significant number of comments, very important comments. It was for a 30-day period, but as all of you know, we continued to accept comments up until today. Executive and Planning has met, as Justice Hall told us, a number of times, twice on August 9th and August 21st to review the recommendations. And I can tell you that we were able to consider all 51, and we will have, as you know, a report presented to you today with recommendations as to every single one of the SEC recommendations. E&P was assisted in this process by the chair of the SEC, Judge Walkup, by the vice chair, Judge McCabe, and by one of the committee members, Judge Ellsworth, and also by the CJA president and a judicial council member, Judge Rubin. They were a part of our review process and there at every moment when we discussed the recommendations. And I want to thank the chief again personally for appointing the SEC members and Judge Rubin to advise us in this regards, because their expert assistance in our review was really invaluable. I want to take just a moment, though, and talk about the process that E&P undertook. First, we received 529 comments from 513 commentators. 30 were from organizations. 84% were from judicial officers. The comments were thorough, they were across the board, and they were extremely helpful, and they were reviewed by us in our process. The comments dealt with a significant number which recommended implementation of the SEC report, that voiced support for the SEC recommendations. Various had differing opinions on implementation and the time for those to occur. A number dealt with the culture at the Judicial Council and the AOC. A number, as we have heard, dealt with access to justice and concerns in that regards. And they really were across the board with regards to the effects that the recommendations might have on the smallest court to the courts of review. When E&P met for the first time on August 9th, we initially started our process of evaluation without any staff. It was just the E&P members and the advisory members that had been appointed to assist us. And we had a number of items that we wanted to discuss in a setting with just ourselves and without staff. The first was, should we have a meeting that was open or closed? We concluded that it was important for our evaluation to have a closed session so that we could talk about confidential personnel matters, and that we could hear confidential information from the SEC members. And we did hear confidential information, and it was important in our evaluation. We next discussed whether or not we should even invite staff in at all. And since a number of us indicated that we couldn't write as fast as all of us talked, we thought it was important to have a staff member there to take down notes. And so we invited three staff members from the Secretariat Office to assist us in taking down notes. Then we wanted to determine whether or not at any point during our discussion if we should invite members from AOC to answer questions. And we agreed that if there were time periods during our discussions where we needed some expert information with regards to a particular recommendation, that we would invite AO staff in. And we did. We invited Jody Patel and Judge Jarre, and they provided us, again, excellent information on the recommendations and the timelines and the impacts. And then lastly, we organized our review in a way that it didn't go from recommendation number 1 to 151. We organized it in a way that it dealt with all of the organizational recommendations first, and then we went division by division. And we were able, again, to get through all 151 and have that report for you today. Now, I'm somewhat sorry for the length of my introductory and background remarks, but executive and planning felt it was important, very important, that you understood the process and that we explain the process that we followed. Now, I know that some have indicated that the purpose of assigning it to executive and planning and the purpose for our review was merely to delay the process, to maybe eventually shelve the process and the report, and to bury it someplace. But I can personally tell you that could not be further from the truth. I'm here today to report that within 2 months of the Judicial Council accepting the report, after reviewing 529 comments and hundreds of pages of the SEC report, and after meeting twice, we have a report to present to you today that deals with all 150 recommendations. We have also established a timeline for implementation and a monitoring process to oversee that the AOC follows what you as a Judicial Council direct. Now, I don't intend, and I don't know that we have enough time, to go over one by one all 150 items, but we can certainly in a moment talk about any of them that you want to, and we can discuss any of E&P's recommendations. But I do want to kind of group this into three important aspects of the work of our committee, and they are, first, those recommendations of the SEC which dealt with Judicial Council oversight, the Judicial Council roles and responsibilities. Second, those which deal with the restructuring of the AOC. And third, and almost most importantly, accountability and the monitoring process that we came up with. I do want to give you just a few statistics first, though. We didn't reject any of the SEC recommendations. 12 of the SEC recommendations have already been implemented. Oh, I'm sorry, 12 were recommended for immediate implementation. 18 had already been completed as of the date of our meeting. 7 had been started to be implemented and were ongoing. 17 dealt with the organizational structure and the proposal in that regards. A total of 38 dealt with the organizational structure and classification and compensation studies. 3 dealt with referrals to the Chief Justice and concerned the assigned judges program, in which constitutionally are not within the authority of the Judicial Council to make recommendations on. 2 were assigned to the Trial Court Budget Working Group, 2 to RUPRO, and 1 to the Technology Committee. So first, those which dealt with the Judicial Council oversight and governance. E&P recommends that the 4 SEC recommendations concerning the Judicial Council oversight and governance be adopted, be approved by you, and be implemented immediately. Now, we do have 1 addition and 1 change, and if you look at Attachment 1, and I think because these are so important and deal, in essence, with what we as a Judicial Council are all about, I do want to just read them. And these are recommendations 4.1 through 4.4 of the SEC report, and on our attachment, they are 2, 3, and 4. The first one is E&P recommends that the Judicial Council take an active role in overseeing and monitoring the AOC to ensure transparency, accountability, and efficiency in the AOC's operations and practices. We recommend that for immediate implementation. E&P recommends that the Judicial Council promote the primary role and orientation of the AOC as a service provider to the Judicial Council and the courts, and we added for the benefit of the public. Next, ENP recommends that the Judicial Council, in exercising its independent and ultimate governance authority over the operations and practices of the AOC, must ensure that the AOC provide it with a comprehensive analysis, including a business case analysis, a full range of options and impacts and pros and cons before undertaking any branch-wide project or initiative. In exercising its authority over committees, rules, grants, programs, and projects, the Judicial Council must ensure that the AOC provide it with a full range of options, impacts, including fiscal, operational, and other impacts on the courts. Again, we recommend that for immediate implementation. Next, ENP recommends that the Judicial Council conduct in the SEC, it was a periodic review. We are recommending an annual review of the performance of the administrative director of the courts. The review must take into consideration input submitted by persons inside and outside the judicial branch. And that, if Judge Jarr takes his job in October, will be initiated in October of 2013. We recommend that you approve and adopt each of those and accept our implementation schedule. Second, restructuring of the AOC. 17 of the SEC recommendations concern the AOC organizational structure. And even though executive and planning essentially agreed with each of these recommendations, we felt it was important, and we wanted to give the interim and the incoming administrative director the opportunity to review these, to consider them, and to provide the council with whatever tweaks or modifications or changes they may have felt fit within their business approach and their vision, and they will provide that to us. We directed them to present it to the Judicial Council today at this meeting in conjunction with our full report because we considered these recommendations significant and important and ones that needed to be dealt with now and not later and needed to be implemented on a very expedited basis. And in a moment, you will hear from Judge Jarr and Jody Patel and Justice Hill with regards to those proposals. And then the third thing I want to stress today is accountability. You know, we can come before you and recommend that you approve these recommendations. You can approve them and direct that they be implemented. And in some sense, that is all in good. But it is equally important to have a system and a process for accountability. So we are proposing the following. For those that have been indicated they have been completed, we are going to ask the AOC to report to us in writing when they were completed, how they were completed, and provide supporting documentation. For those that are in the process or ongoing, or for those that require a report back to the Judicial Council, or for those that we have set a timeline and need to be implemented in the future, we are going to ask that they report to Executive and Planning on a monthly basis, that the report be in writing, that it be provided with supporting documentation so that we can evaluate where they are in that process, how they are proceeding, and whether they are accomplishing the implementation goals that we have set. And then Executive and Planning will report back to the Council at each of their meetings. We felt it was important not just to have a report back to you at the Judicial Council meeting, but to have Executive and Planning monitoring on a monthly basis so that we were up to date on where they were in that regards, and so we could monitor that aspect. So what I would like to do at this time is turn it over to Judge Jarr to talk about those 17 SEC recommendations that deal with the organizational structure. And Judge Jarr.
Thank you, Justice Miller, and thank you all for the opportunity to be heard this morning. As has been indicated, the report of the Strategic Evaluation Committee is global in nature as it relates to the administrative office. The presentation that Jody Patel and I will be making at this juncture will be focused on the executive office reorganization component of the SEC report, and it is hoped we will be able to demonstrate a plan for your approval that is most advantageous in the reorganization of the office. So our focus will be on the executive office with a few additions, and I will note them, which will actually address a total of no more than 21 of the 151 recommendations. First order of business, we have materials to follow along with the presentation. They include, of course, the slides that are being presented with the space for taking notes. Toward the end are blow-ups of organizational charts. Don't spend much time on them right now because we intend to address them in the course of our presentation. And then at the very conclusion, there is an index. The index is to essentially our recommendations in reference to the Executive and Planning Committee's report, referencing the Executive and Planning Committee's report numbers, so that you can cross-reference, because our presentation won't follow that numerically. I learned in leadership in another organization that underwent a complete transformation that all organizations, be they private or public, require periodic self-assessment if they are to remain healthy organizations. Why is that? Each organization engages daily in problem solving. Some problems are known in advance and others come forward spontaneously. But organizations must address them and they must resolve them. And each solution to each problem has an incremental impact on the organization, necessarily. In the isolation, it's an insignificant impact, usually. But over time, in the aggregate, those incremental changes, adjustments, solutions, and movements in the organization change its course. They constitute, in the aggregate, in other words, an unintended consequence of simply conducting the operations of the organization. So, a periodic self-assessment process is a natural process with respect to every organization, I submit. Here, as has been indicated already by our chief and by Justice Miller, the administrative office, as observed in the SEC report, has grown considerably over the last 10 to 14 years, in major part because it has assumed new responsibilities on delegation to the council and accordingly to that office by the legislature and the governor. That growth obviously has resulted in a number of actions and reactions, and so today we address the report and recommendation of the SEC that was commissioned by the chief as one of her first steps and supported by the council. What caught my attention as a private citizen on the sideline was that that process was announced to be a public process. It was going to be a process of self-assessment that occurred in broad daylight. When the report was received after considerable labor, it was placed out for public comment. And then, as has been mentioned, the Executive and Planning Committee assessed the public comments that came in to you. One of the central findings in the report as it relates to the executive office organizational structure is that it has, with these new responsibilities, over time grown and become top-heavy. It is indicated in the report that that overbreadth in terms of its sheer size, that is to say the executive office, has resulted in a sort of segregation which is referred to as a silo effect. The authors of the SEC report have proposed a remedy, and the remedy is executive management restructure. And with minor modifications, we agree. I say minor, I should indicate, I don't mean to suggest trivial. I believe that they are significant and important modifications, but they are minor in the sense that I submit also they do not represent departures either from the thematic underpinnings of the SEC report or the structural recommendations that are made in the main. So the SEC proposes that we reduce the size of the executive team in order to improve the management of the administrative office, and we agree. That reduction in size will streamline decision-making, and it will also enhance and make more clear the lines of communication and authority within the administrative office, just as I have pledged as your incoming administrative director to broaden and make more clear the avenues of communication between the courts that we serve and the administrative office. The report writers for the SEC propose a clustering or grouping of the existing offices of the council based upon function. For example, a grouping together of offices with programmatic functions, the education division would be a good example, and a grouping together of the administrative functions, for example, finance. With that recommendation, we also agree. The first organizational chart, which is rather small on your screens and is reproduced accordingly in your materials, indicates the current state of affairs organizationally within the administrative office. And as you can see, over time, a number of divisions and offices have been developed. Each of them reports to a two-person executive office. Presently, the administrative director and the chief deputy director don't have denominated separate functions or areas of responsibility in the organization chart. The authors of the SEC report note that from a historical perspective, as the outside demands on the administrative office have been increased, particularly those associated with legislative activity and executive branch activity, the administrative director and the chief deputy director in the past came to emphasize more and more their external duties and responsibilities. An unintended effect of that was that internal management issues began to accumulate. The SEC accordingly has proposed a transformation in the structure of the executive office. It proposes a four-person executive office model. Immediately beneath the judicial council would remain the administrative director. Working with that individual would be three division chiefs, a chief of staff, a chief administrative officer, and a chief operations officer. With those recommendations, we agree. The reason for that structure, as explained in the SEC report, is that it will enable the administrative director to meet the demands from the legislature and the executive branch, because an effective management of internal operations and programs may be assumed by three high-level leadership positions. And as indicated in the report, those three positions would be viewed as co-equal, and there must be to them a robust delegation of duty by the administrative director. I would note that in the chain of command, it is my proposal and the proposal of our interim director that the chief of staff be designated. That's a variation from the SEC report, which identifies the chief operating officer. We believe and submit that the chief of staff is the person to whom second in command responsibilities should be addressed, and in a little bit more detail momentarily we'll reveal why. But fundamentally, the chief of staff, as identified in the SEC report, is a person who will have high-level duties of responsibility to the judicial council. But not just that, that person also will have a high-level liaison responsibility to the trial courts. It's important to recognize, of course, that within the AOC, there are any number of points of responsibility and contact between entities within the AOC and the trial courts. But the SEC thoughtfully indicated that at the very top of the management structure, there has to be one clear line to ensure that to the extent that problems arise relative to the efficient and effective communication between the office and the trial courts, someone within the executive office has those duties. It's for these reasons that the chief of staff, who would be charged with that liaison function, would serve as second in command in circumstances when the administrative director is unavailable, so as to ensure continuity of operations. Well, what about the existing divisions that you saw in the organization chart? What becomes of them? The existing divisions would become offices within the organizational structure, and each of them would report to one of the three divisions and division chiefs created at the recommendation of SEC. The offices would remain headed by directors, as they are now known. Their duties would be unchanged and certainly undiminished. The SEC report makes in several spots references to compensation levels. It also strongly recommends that a comprehensive classification and compensation study be conducted throughout the AOC. It is our recommendation that no compensation adjustments be made with regard to the directors until that entire study has been completed. The proposed structure, once again set forth within the report, is to create a chief of staff who would head what we have denominated the Judicial Council and Court Leadership Services Division. I believe it's referred to as the Executive Office in the SEC report. The chief of staff would be responsible for special projects and units, and as mentioned previously, would coordinate administrative office support of and to the Judicial Council, and also provide that crucial high-level liaison responsibility directly to the trial courts. The chief administrative officer, who would be responsible for what has been denominated the Judicial and Court Administrative Services Division, would have oversight of AOC business support functions that are not program specific, as I mentioned previously, for example, financial services, both to the council and the courts. Finally, the chief operating officer, who would head the Judicial and Court Operations Services Division, would have oversight of core business and service ventures and customer-oriented court programs, to use the words of the SEC report. In other words, programs such as the Family Center for Family and Children and the courts, the Education Division, and the like. With all of these recommendations, we agree. We've set up two slides to show areas where there is either a modification or at least a potential adjustment from those recommendations contained in the SEC report regarding the executive office organization. As I mentioned previously, we recommend that the chief of staff be designated as a second in command in circumstances in which the administrative director is unavailable. The SEC report indicates that the Office of General Counsel, which is to be renamed Legal Services Office, have a direct and uninterrupted line of report to the administrative director. We propose and recommend that that direct line remain to the administrative director. However, that there be a direct report through the chief of staff in consideration of the considerable volume of opinion writing and other services provided by that office concerning not only the council and council activities, but the trial courts, and that that direct line pass through the chief of staff to the new executive office. With regard to the Office of Governmental Affairs, the SEC report recommends differently that there be a direct report to the chief of staff. Here it is our belief and submission that the OGA director and the OGA office should have a direct report relationship to the administrative director. The reason being that, as the SEC report noted, this organizational structural change is designed, among other things, to ensure that the administrative director will have the ability to focus on external demands on the council and on the office, most notably, of course, those emanating from the executive and the legislative branches in Sacramento. Obviously, that means the working relationship between the administrative director and OGA will be constant and, obviously, in some instances, acute. In order to enable the two to work together as nimbly as possible, it is our view that the OGA director accordingly should report to the administrative director. The editing and graphics group indicated in the SEC report to be eliminated, we propose instead to be merged into the Judicial Council Support Services Unit. It has been observed properly that to the extent that there are duplicative services performed by editing and graphics and others, those necessarily have to be ended. But that is our recommendation concerning that element. Now, here's a recommendation that doesn't appear in the SEC report. I don't believe it is one that is inconsistent with the recommendations in the SEC report, but one that is crucial in our judgment for immediate action by the council, and that is we recommend that the Office of Court Construction and Management be bifurcated, that an Office of Facilities Management reporting to the Chief Administrative Officer be created. In other words, that the maintenance and management activities within that office be separately officed. simultaneously that the design and construction functions of the Office of Court Construction and Management also be placed in a separate office, and that activity be more in the nature of a court operation or program being placed under the responsibility of the Chief Operations Officer. And more on that in a moment. The Office of Emergency Response and Security, the SEC report indicates that the services and duties of that office should be reapportioned into existing AOC offices and that the office itself should be closed. It is our fervent recommendation that the office, a focal point for security issues which are central to the branch, remain open. The Executive and Planning Committee kindly proposed to defer decision relative to that issue until the December 2012 meeting to enable Jody Patel and myself to prepare a report of advocacy concerning that topic so the matter could be considered on its merits at that juncture, and we ask that you adopt the E&P recommendation in that regard at this time. Already mentioned the director compensation issue, asking that all those kinds of decisions be deferred pending completion of a classification and compensation study. We also recommend that there be a merger of traditional administrative functions into a newly established Office of Administrative Services reporting directly to the Chief Administrative Officer. Many of those things have actually occurred in terms of the kinds of reforms that Jody Patel, as interim director, has put into place, unknown in many quarters, but known well to the council. Extraordinary progress has been achieved during her period of stewardship since February, and in many respects, changes have occurred to the very world that the SEC members were investigating at the time they prepared their report. The last example of which is the last bullet item on this slide. In light of the realignment changes in criminal law sentencing in our state, enormous in their scope, the administrative office reorganized criminal justice services into the Criminal Justice Services Office. And it is recommended that that office, as an operations-related activity, be placed under the Chief Operating Officer. What arises from the recommendations is a proposed organizational structure. Once again, that appears toward the foot of your materials in a way that can be read a little bit better. We have placed next to it in your materials from the SEC report its proposed administrative structure for the organization of the AOC, and I would suggest that it mirrors our own proposed structure with the modifications that have been noted. What also flows from this recommendation, as it does from the SEC report, is that the position of Chief Deputy Director and the position of each of the three regional directors should be eliminated. Now, don't go too far into each of the divisions and the offices that are clustered under them, because momentarily Jody Patel will give you more of an analysis of each. First, however, I'd like to return to the issue of the Office of Court Construction and Management. To make it clear, the recommendation that we now make for your consideration is not punitive in nature. It is, in our view, the necessary first step to ensure that the recommendations of the SEC relating to the Office of Court Construction and Management can be most effectively implemented. To start at the beginning, about 10 years ago, significant legislation came into effect that had the impact of transferring responsibility for court facilities to the state, and more particularly to the Judicial Council. The court facilities that were in place for trial courts throughout California, numbering in the many hundreds, were to transfer, literally, ownership to the state of California, and the Judicial Council was to oversee that process. In addition, whereas previously it had always been county responsibility to construct new courthouses, that responsibility now was also placed in the state, and more particularly in the Judicial Council. Flowing obviously from both new construction and from transfers of old buildings, many of which suffered deferred maintenance at the hands of counties that knew they were shortly going to lose title to them, flows the new responsibility of management and maintenance. It was natural at the beginning of the project that the council essentially place in the administrative office the responsibility of beginning those processes, and that the administrative office would create one new office or division to begin to address them. Now there has been considerable maturation in those processes. Buildings are being built. Even as we have pauses in a number of the construction projects, there's obviously considerable ongoing activity on the design and construction side. On the management and maintenance side, all of those transfers have occurred. Hundreds and hundreds of buildings, many with maintenance problems that are severe, as you well know. These are two separate, severable activities. Design and construction on the one hand, maintenance and management on the other. The time has come, in our judgment, for those two activities to be severed so that they can each be performed more effectively and efficiently. Interestingly, Jody Patel and I discovered that each of us had independently reached that conclusion. The recently published Pegasus report at pages 421 through 424 reveals its conclusion that indeed the design and construction function is entirely separate from the maintenance and management function. Justice Hill, who kindly agreed to travel here today for a brief presentation, is, as you know, the chair of the Working Group on Core Construction, which you created to oversee construction activities within OCCM, and I understand that he supports this recommendation. He also has some additional recommendations alluded to on the screen relative to working group oversight in your behalf of not only construction and modification activity, but also the important maintenance activity. And Justice Hill, if I could impose on you.
Certainly. Thank you very much, and Chief, members of the council. I fully support the recommendations as set forth to separate the two elements of the court construction and the maintenance program from one another. Our executive committee of the Court Facilities Working Group also fully supports this approach and believes that it will be extremely beneficial to both components of the program to be separate and distinct. They are separate and distinct, and it is necessary that full attention be given to each in a different setting than is currently operational. In addition to expanding the charge of the working group, and I think that, quite frankly, the court modification working group that looks at court facility modifications, those modifications like elevators and roofs and significant expenditures of funds, needs to be expanded so that that working group can review all maintenance items. The maintenance program, we believe, should have active oversight by judges and by court executive officers. There is not that form of oversight at this time. There should be, and there will be, under this recommendation. Finally, I've addressed you a number of times before about decentralized maintenance, something that I believe over time many courts support. Quite frankly, although we've heard that the present system is working for many courts would also like the opportunity to handle their own maintenance. And it's our obligation to see if we can make that work. It's also our obligation not to turn it over to the courts with inadequate funding, which is what we would be doing right now. The funding for maintenance is certainly, as you've heard before, inadequate, and courts would be spending, in essence, pennies on the dollar, or be given pennies on the dollar, to maintain their dilapidating and inadequate facilities that they have been dealing with for years and years and years. We need to move down that path. We are moving down that path. We have a pilot project in place to make sure that we can get all of the bugs out for this decentralized maintenance. We need to make sure that that works. We need to make sure to get the funding. And once we do all of that, I'm sure that someone will be back from the court facilities or court modification and maintenance working group to address to you the reasons why, to the extent possible, we should decentralize maintenance. Obviously, if there are courts in the state who cannot adequately oversee these responsibilities and maintain their courts, the AOC will be there and will certainly help those courts. But for those many courts who have come to us saying they would like to be involved in this process and they would like to ultimately take over this process, we need to be there for them as well. I would just like to applaud the efforts that have just been enunciated to strengthen both of these programs. I believe that it's a timely proposal. It's a necessary reform, and it's one that I certainly urge adoption by the council. Thank you, and thank you.
Thank you, Justice Hill. In sum, as to OCCM, we request that the council direct the administrative office to bifurcate that office into the two that have been proposed, that we in the executive office work closely with Lee Willoughby, manager of OCCM, to ensure that an implementation plan for that separation can be devised, which is not disruptive of the important daily functions both sides of that house conduct, and that we bring that proposed plan back to you and your council at the December meeting for its consideration, and it is hoped approval, so that the process can be begun, which in turn, in my view, will facilitate addressing not only the recommendations of SEC, but now the Pegasus recommendations. And with Justice Hill's permission, I would certainly ask that you, at this juncture, consider expanding the charge of the Working Group on Modification to include oversight of maintenance and management. Now, as I promised previously, we're going to get into a little bit more detail, drill down, if you will, regarding the three proposed new divisions: Operations Services, Administrative Services, and then the Leadership Services Division, which would be headed by the Chief of Staff. I'm going to turn the chair over to Jody Patel, given that the screen controls are here.
Yeah. It's
all right.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Jarr. Good morning, Chief, members of the council. As Judge Jarr just indicated, I will provide a little bit more specificity with regard to the areas of responsibility for the Chief of Staff, Chief Admin Officer, and Chief Operating Officer. For the Chief of Staff, this individual will lead the Judicial Council and Court Services, Court Leadership Services Division. This individual will provide and support the Judicial Council, the trial court presiding judges, and court executive officers' advisory committees, the trial court liaison office, formerly known as the regional office, and special projects office, formerly known as the reengineering unit, which was housed in the Northern Central Regional Office. The org chart in front of you denotes that the Chief of Staff's areas of responsibilities. You will note, as Judge Jarr indicated, the Legal Services Office would be a direct report to the Chief of Staff, with a line of reporting also directly to the Administrative Director. And the red on these org charts represents the change that Judge Jarr indicated in terms of the slight modifications that we've made to the SEC recommendations. The Chief Administrative Officer leads the Judicial Court Administrative Services Division. This area will house all of your traditional administrative services for the Judicial Council, AOC, and the Judicial Branch. Under the Chief Administrative Officer, we will have the Fiscal Services Office, currently known as the Finance Division, our HR, Human Resources Services Office, which on April the 1st was temporarily merged with our Trial Court Administrative Services Division as a result of some personnel changes. We recommend, consistent with the SEC, that be once again bifurcated from the Trial Court Administrative Services Office and be a standalone Human Resources Services Office. Also under the CAO is the Trial Court Administrative Services Office. All of your Phoenix financial and HR activities reside under that office, and our IT services would also be under the CAO. The two modifications from the SEC recommendations are the last two boxes that you see in front of you. The Office of Administrative Services, which would be a new office that would house normal administrative services that are provided not just to the council and AOC, but to other branch entities, such as reception staff here in this building, mailroom operations, copy services, as well as records. And we felt that it was important for all of those activities, which currently reside under our education division, to be a standalone office under the CAO. And lastly, as both Judge Jarre and Justice Hill, you've just heard, the Office of Facilities Management, that would include maintenance as well as asset management, would reside under the CAO. The Chief Operating Officer leads the Judicial and Court Operations Services Division. This will house all of your normal programs and activities that support court programs, operations, all of the collaborative services with regard to our trial courts and appellate courts, as well as other court services. And once again, you have in front of you the organization chart for the Chief Operating Officer, or COO for short. The COO would be responsible for Court Operations Special Services Office, currently known as the Court Programs and Services Division, the Center for Families and Children, our Education Division, and CEJR. The last three boxes in red are the site modifications from what the SEC recommended. First, we would have our Office of Judicial Branch Capital Programs, which once again is something that Judge Jarre and Justice Hill just discussed with regard to our court construction program and activities. We also have our Criminal Justice Services Office. And as Judge Jarre indicated, this is an office, historically the activities of this office were housed with our Bay Area Northern Central Regional Office, and was responsible for items such as reentry court, implementation of the legislatively mandated work of SB 677. However, with the criminal realignment legislation that went into effect, and which was basically the catalyst for us merging the realignment activities with that office, it made sense for us to create a standalone office called Criminal Justice Services Office, in light and recognition of the fact that criminal operations and criminal filings in all of our trial courts are the highest volume areas in each of the trial courts. And so, and we believe that the Criminal Justice Services Office will continue to provide support to our courts and to the legislature and other entities on an ongoing basis, which made sense to then make it its own office. And lastly, as Judge Jarre mentioned, the Office of Security, we request that you allow us an opportunity to evaluate the functions and activities of our Office of Security and come back to you in December with a recommendation with regard to what their core functions would be along with their staffing needs. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Judge Jarre and then Justice Miller.
Well, thank you all once again for the opportunity to be heard. I don't think that, as I say, it's any surprise that so many changes have already occurred since the members of the SEC began authorship of their report, largely due to the initiative of Jody Patel as interim director. She chose not to simply act as a placeholder, far from it. The accomplishments that she has definitely credited our agency are really quite remarkable. She and Kurt Soderlund, who's worked hand in hand with her, have made huge progress and have also dealt with some of the most unpleasant aspects of the work. As you know, during her tenure, well more than 200 staff members have left the agency as a consequence of the dire budget circumstances that have occurred. So this is a time of great challenge. And I submit to you, accordingly, it's a time of great opportunity, particularly given the leadership that the chief and the council have shown in this enterprise. We thank the Executive and Planning Committee for enabling us to make this presentation this morning, and we request now that with respect to the Executive Office reorganizational components of the SEC report, that its recommendations be adopted with the modifications that we have proposed. We also request, with respect to implementation, that you order the establishment of a new Executive Office operational by October 1 of this year, with concurrent action to begin implementation of divisional reorganization, that you direct our interim director to begin that process pending my first day as an employee on October the 8th, and we ask that you direct our office to report back to you at your October and then again your December meetings regarding progress toward that implementation. Justice Miller.
Thank you, Judge Jarr. And just in closing, again, I want to thank the Chief for commissioning the SEC report. I want to thank, again, the three SEC members who are now judicial council members for your past, and I stress past, hard work and the difficult tasks that you undertook and completed so valiantly. But now the recommendations are ours. They now are the judicial council's. And we own them. And together, all of us as a judicial council must assume the important responsibility to implement and monitor the recommendations which I hope you approve today. But even with your approval, unfortunately, our work won't magically end today. As we've heard from the public comments both yesterday and today, we have to continually strive to improve, to continually strive to enhance access to justice, to serve the courts and the public, and I think importantly to continue, which the Chief has started, to look deeply inward and perform self-assessment. And again, as we heard today, in this process we will certainly have differing opinions, we will certainly have disagreements, we will certainly have strong discussions as to which path we should travel. But I believe that as a branch, we must now move forward, and we must turn the corner together. So thank you, Chief.
Thank you for the presentation. This is now open for comment. Judge McKay.
Thank you, Chief. As one of the SEC members appointed to the EMP committee, I want to give my perspective, consistent with what I reported to the recent trial court presiding judge and CEO committee, I was pleasantly surprised by the process that was undertaken by EMP committee. I thought it was methodical, thoughtful, thorough. The SEC members were not only present, but our input was solicited. And so we were an active participant in the process. Material was laid out in a grouped form rather than in chronological order. It is grouped by subject matter and divisions, which I found to be quite helpful in the way we approach this. As I stated at the June Judicial Council meeting, it was the position of the SEC that this go through the natural process. We're an industry where our industry is built on due process. And I think I answered one of the questions to the presiding judges, is would any of you as a judge have accepted 151 recommendations and then adopted them immediately? And I think the answer is no. You allowed the process to occur. And that's exactly what the SEC urged. That was what the council urged and ultimately adopted and submitted to the EMP. I was also pleasantly surprised and comforted by the fact that it wasn't parceled out to different committees. It was kept within one committee, the EMP. EMP has taken ownership and wants to monitor the progress. So not only are they reviewing the recommendations, making recommendations, but they also want to go further and be the contact point, responsible for overseeing the implementation. And I think that's thoughtful and appropriate. And so I want folks to know that I'm pleasantly surprised and quite comforted in the fact that This has taken a normal course, a thoughtful and judicious course, and there's nothing inappropriate about it. Next, I'd like to note that when we went through the materials, the recommendations themselves that were submitted by the SEC, almost 1,000%, I mean, baseball terms, were accepted. You know, the statistic, if you figure out statistically what those numbers are, those not only are all-star numbers, they're Hall of Fame numbers. So we encountered none of the rumored resistance. It was a cooperative spirit. Folks were interested in looking at each of them on their own merit. I'll note that there were a few of them, I think three of them, that dealt with the assigned judges program that we subsequently learned was constitutionally in the chief's discretion only. EMP communicated with the chief, whom indicated, send them to me as is and I'll consider them. And I thought, fair enough. But other than those three, none were rejected outright. In fact, if you call modification rejection, which I don't, there are only those three, and those three weren't within our purview. Our bad. We learned something that day. I would like to note that this has been presented for public comment two times. When the report was initially placed on the website on May 25th, and then again when it came to the Judicial Council for another 30-day comment period. Unless you were in a coma or in Mars, you've had an opportunity to comment. And that's what the process is about. That's what this industry and branch is about. And I'm comforted in knowing that we went extra steps to make sure everybody's voice was heard. And I think you should be proud that you resisted pressures, external pressures, to rush it. Because not many things good come out of being rushed. So congratulations is in order for the steady deliberative process. The court, or I know, court, boy, am I confused. Wish I was at court, so much simpler. There have been time estimates provided by the AOC for implementation of a number of the items. In my opinion, they are overly optimistic. I applaud you for attempting to get these done in the time frames in which you've said, but I would warn everybody, if they don't get done, don't be surprised. I don't expect all of them wholesale aren't going to get done, but just some of these are going to take time to develop. You cannot change the course of a battleship on a dime. And in some cases, I think that's what's being done, and I think it's being done in a cooperative spirit, and I appreciate the AOC attempting to do that. But I'm mindful it's probably not going to happen in some of the instances. So patience to those folks who believe that that is a stalling tactic or an attempt to delay. It's not. These things take time, and I'm well aware that that's, in fact, what may be occurring. I noted in also at the June Judicial Council meeting, and I think it was in response to a question from Judge Rosenberg, that the new administrative director of the courts, ADOC, should be given some flexibility to place their leadership style and imprint on the organization. The structure that was presented by the SEC is more akin to a pyramid leadership. ADOC at the point, we now have three directors in the midsection, and then you have office directors at the base, the foundation. And that's how that structure is presented. The old structure was a mastabus. Now calling on you to remember sixth grade, for those that have kids. That's a flat-topped edifice, like those built by the Mayan cultures and others. And that's what the old structure looked like. It was unwieldy. Too many direct reports, too many voids for leadership, compounded by the fact that the two principal leaders, the ADOC and the chief deputy director, were so busy and consumed with external matters. So this new structure, I'm pleased that it's being embraced. It should eliminate a lot of those gaps that occurred in the past. And please don't misunderstand me. It's not my opinion due to malfeasance or any malintent. It just happened. It developed over time. And so this structure, I think, will help, not eliminate, but help to eliminate that reoccurring in the future. The court. I want to get back home. The interim ADOC and the appointed ADOC have recommended some changes. Those changes, I'll note with some just basic information and background. First, the chief of staff as the second in command. That differs from the SEC recommendation, which the chief operating officer be the second in command. Again, I think it's stylistic, and so I'm not getting too hung up on it. The SEC's position was the COO is somebody that's at the shop every day, so there's never a gap because they're never gone. And any time there's the ADOC is out doing what they need to do externally, if there's an issue and a decision needs to be made, you have somebody there to make it. In this case, the court. I note that the ADOC is probably going to have a time commitment on external matters anywhere from probably 70 to 80% away. The chief of staff is probably going to be in the 50 to 60%. And these are just rough estimates. Whereas the COO and the CAO are virtually zero. They're there at the Mint minding the Mint. And so that's the theory in it. But I will note there is no one way to do these things. And it can work. Just there should be effort and great care in noting that part of the silo effect was developed because you had the two major leaders out working the external issues and nobody's home to make a decision. So if the chief of staff is going to be the second command, be mindful of the history, one, and two, make sure that there is either very strong communication or there's an assignment. And that's all I would note on that issue. On OGC and OGA, if you look at the SEC's chart, really the proposal by AOC just flips the two. And again, it's in my opinion, it's stylistic. One had SEC had OGC directly reporting to the ADOC, and that the OGA was buried in, and I don't mean that in a negative term, but it was housed in the executive office under the tutelage and oversight of the chief of staff. What has been proposed today flips the two, and to me, what that signals is it's just a difference of priority. Things are hot right now in the first and second branch. I think everybody here gets that. And so there's a need to make sure that there is unimpeded communication, contact, and lines of communication between the ADOC and OGA. I would note this is a managerial structure. It's not intended to be militaristic. Military system is chain of command, and everything, including communications, follow that rigid structure. AOC hasn't adopted that type of style or system, and I don't believe it's going to in the future. So the system that we have is a managerial system, and the ADOC has the freedom to communicate with anybody they want and require anybody to directly report to them on a daily basis, if so, if they want. So I'm not discomforted by the modification because, again, I think it's stylistic. And I've already said, and be consistent with that statement, is the new ADOC should have that flexibility. So I point that out. I would note the policy and basis for having OGA in the executive office, however, was one, the three main middle leaders, which is the COO, CAO, and the COS, Chief of Staff. Those folks are broken down in the following areas. COA is operations. That's their expertise. And they should have a strong court background in order to... COO, I'm sorry, COO should have a strong background in court, since it's service to primarily courts. That the CAO, that's dealing with fiscal, should have a strong fiscal background, and that's an administrative capacity. So there's the ADOC's fiscal, one of the fiscal experts, whereas the COS is really the policy advisor, should have a strong either first or second. And these are ideal, I know it's not a perfect world, and we know that you're going to find the best folks that you can to meet your model. But our thinking was you want a first and second branch background with lots of court experience so that you understand the politics and the policy, and so the COS person would have those components. And so that's kind of the thinking there. Thus, the proposed model removes the COS from the loop. Is it that important? Again, it's stylistic. And I'm certainly not here to dictate to you how your leadership style should be. The ADOC has 500 things to do. Having a direct report now means that you're also supervising a director, evaluations, et cetera. So now you have 501 things to do versus having the chief of staff do that and have the OGA as a direct communication only. But again, stylistic. As long as you're aware of these policy considerations, the basis for the decision, and nonetheless would like to go down that road, fantastic, then you've made an informed decision. Next, OCCM. The bifurcation seems, quite frankly, to me to be consistent with what the SEC attempted to do, and that was to group this by function. And so I note that is consistent and have no further comment on that point. Editing, if to retain an editing office, there are some redundancies. Be aware of those and attempt to reduce those. OERS, which is security, aware that other states have independent standalones. Understand that you're recommending that be decided in December, the December meeting, not now, since you'll do further information. The SEC recognized the statutory requirements and the importance of security. It wasn't our attempt to eliminate it, rather fold it into other like functions. But again, I recognize, as does the committee, that there's no one right way to do it. And so I'll leave it at that. The CRIM office that's being built, that's an office at the lower level. It's not within the leadership chain, so it doesn't change the pyramid to a mastabus. And so, you know, by all means, if you need to build more offices in order to create clarity or focus, I think that's stylistic. And again, have at it, although be mindful, and I think you are, there are budgetary impacts when you do that because you're elevating somebody to run an office. Last thing I'll note is that these recommendations, particularly dealing with structure, are not fiscal-based. They are intended to ignore fiscal problems. This is a long-term solution to deal with an organization and its leadership. So good times and bad, this should survive, but being, again, tweaked to meet the stylistic needs and type of leadership that the ADOC that is in place at the time at AOC. So fiscal was really not our point. If that was your perception, please don't eliminate that from your thinking, because we did not do that. And then there's been a number of comments regarding fiscal analysis. This was not, and it was not the SEC's intent that AOC become an organization that makes every decision based on fiscal analysis. Its intent was that you should have a full spectrum of analysis, which could include fiscal impacts, and that it was our experience and the evidence indicated that sometimes decisions were made without a full fiscal impact, among other analysis. And so we are, again, trying to create a structure and a system that minimizes the lack of process that was evident in the past. And I so agree with what was said by some of the speakers earlier. We looked at the past, we looked at the present, but this really is geared towards the future, because it really is all about the future, right? And so we hope that this model will accommodate the needs. I think I've commented enough on all those issues and on each of the modification proposals. I would reiterate, folks, on the time estimates, overly optimistic in my opinion. And with that, thank you, Chief.
Thank you for those remarks and the perspective, Judge McCabe. Very helpful to us. Judge Wacob.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Judge McCabe always beats me to the mic, so I won't repeat everything he says, but I agree with his comments. Every day is a school day with Judge McCabe. We always learn a new vocabulary. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. It's always interesting and sometimes humorous. Let me see if I can name that tune in 5 minutes or less. First of all, in the category of handing out thanks, we appreciate the recognition we've received. But what's missing, I think, is, Chief, you deserve a lot of credit for undertaking this self-assessment. When you asked us to do this work, you made it pretty clear that this was to be a no-holds-barred examination, and what we found was going to be what we found, and that's what happened. You're to be commended for that. I think it benefits the branch. I don't think that the members of the committee, myself included, have adequately expressed our gratitude for the opportunity to engage in this work. True, it was labor-intensive. It took us away from our courts. We don't remember how to work on the bench anymore. But it was a wonderful opportunity to try to contribute to the branch moving forward, so we appreciate the opportunity. Justice Miller commented on the hundreds of public comments that were generated and received in response to the report being put out for public comment. But I think I can say safely that the members of the committee, amongst ourselves, received hundreds of private comments from judges and court personnel and court executives around the state, many of whom are not affiliated with any group. They are just working judges or working court personnel who read the report and called us up, sent us an email, sent us a letter, and said, you know what, thank you. We think our concerns were heard and that our concerns have a voice, and we appreciated that. So when I hear 500 comments, I know it to be many, many more that read and considered the report. Just the bullet points on several of the modifications or differences in what Judge Jarr and Jody are recommending for the organizational structure. I would say that at the time that the SEC prepared its report, we examined Office of Court Construction and Management. We knew from our site visits, from our interviews, from our examination of their operations and structure that changes were needed. And we also knew at that time that the Pegasus report was out there and it was forthcoming. We didn't have the advantage of that. We think that the recommendations made in that report, you know, were actually somewhat predictable, that some of those functions needed to be reorganized. in a better, more functional, operational way. So we agree with that. We agree with what Justice Hill said here this morning on that. That is consistent with the attempt that the SEC made to divide operations and functions in the organizational chart in a meaningful, understanding way. The other changes with respect to legal services, I would agree with Judge McCabe. Those are policy choices. Those are maybe even stylistic choices. Those are livable. We understand as a committee that what we did was we made recommendations only, and they are just that. They can be disregarded or embraced. The one comment I would make in closing with respect to the modifications proposed to the AOC structure is that the most significant modification proposed is to put the Office of Governmental Affairs with the direct line report to the Administrative Director of the courts. I'll just reiterate, and that's fine, that's one way to go, but I'll reiterate the rationale of the SEC in recommending something slightly different. We envisioned as sort of a natural division of operations that an executive office would be formed with the chief of staff, and that would house essentially the policy arm of the AOC and the Judicial Council. So our recommendation included Judicial Council support in the executive office. Also, we attempted to elevate the needs of the trial courts by and the courts in general by having court support and liaison services within the executive office so that those concerns are brought to a higher level than they have been before. That's one of the things we heard consistently and uniformly up and down the state when we conducted our work. And also, obviously, government affairs would be part of the policy arm or policy division under the executive office. What is being suggested here now, in my respectful opinion, disengages the Office of Governmental Affairs from the Chief of Staff. It creates an opportunity for a standalone division who structurally is out of the loop with the executive office. Is that something that everybody can live with? Sure. I think it's important to note that what we proposed in no way, we think, impedes the functional operation of the Office of Governmental Affairs, so that when there is a bill pending or there's some pressing need, there's no preclusion whatsoever from the Office of Governmental Affairs communicating with whomever that person needs to communicate with, be it yourself, Chief, PCLC, Administrative Director, or whomever. So there's a difference between the functional operation of what we envisioned by placing the executive office as we did and the sort of structural placement of that organization here. So with that one comment as being, in my opinion, the most notable deviation from what was proposed in the SEC report, I would conclude my remarks and thank you again for the opportunity to comment. We also did appreciate very much the opportunity to participate with the EMP committee meeting to provide our input. But thank you.
Thank you, Judge McCabe, for your perspective as well and your comments. I believe, I'm sorry, Judge Walkup, Judge McCabe, I'm sorry, Judge Walkup. And now we'll hear from Judge Ellsworth.
I would like to, as a member of the SEC committee, also join the comments that have been made by, but now I never had brothers growing up. I have a couple now. Working hand in hand with these gentlemen has been a great honor. I want to just make two points, and that is also joining their comments and agreeing with both of them. I want to assure anyone listening around this table or on the airways that there is nothing that's been hidden. If you think that you can place McCabe and Walkup and Ellsworth on a EMP as advisory and think that we will sit fettered in the corner without giving our opinions. You don't know us very well at all. I heard you giggle down there, Malik. But the reality has been, the reality has been that Justice Miller listened to us prior to these meetings beginning. He asked for our advice on how to proceed. We had sometimes daily phone calls with one of the three of us in anticipation of the meetings. And then after each of these meetings and during these meetings, Justice Miller made it very clear that we were the experts, that we were the individuals to go to and to ask these questions of. And at no time did I feel that we weren't heard. And in fact, I can say that the discussion dialogue sometimes reversed based on what one of the three of us would say. And afterwards, Justice Miller would get on that phone with one of the three of us and say, how did that go? Is that acceptable? Are you in agreement with those things? Are we handling this? So I want everyone to be very clear that there's nothing been hidden or chased away or voices not heard, that the experts are being relied on. And we are being heard, and I felt that we really needed to be on that EMP. The second comment and the closing comment is, this is all important. We're at the beginning here. We're at the beginning. You've received the report. It's been accepted. It's sent to EMP. But for me, the most critical piece of all of this is the review, is watching what really happens. And so I, again, appreciate, Chief, so much the opportunity to sit as an expert, as a member of the SEC, along with EMP as advisory, as they receive back these reports on a monthly basis, and so that we can also comment and continue to oversee this. And I want to assure everyone that the three of us as SEC members and now going to beginning our Judicial Council opportunity, we all are very, very dedicated to making sure that the true spirit of change for the best and change in the branch and opportunity and the opportunity to go forward from here will be something that is within all of our sights, and we are dedicated to making that happen. And thank you again, Chief, for probably the greatest opportunity, one of the most difficult opportunities in my life for all kinds of reasons, not just the hard work, but some of the unfair fans and unfair critics, but regardless, it has changed my life personally, and I know that of my two brothers here. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I would say certainly under the leadership of Judge Wacob and the contribution of the SEC members, we are at a turning point in our branch. We really are at a crossroads that I think just the review process alone has improved us, and so where do we go from here? I think, Judge Baker, you had your hand up at one point, and then Judge Rosenberg.
All right. Well, I certainly – thank you, Chief. I certainly concur with all the comments about the process, and especially Judge Wacob's comments about your insight, Chief, and your leadership in undertaking this monumental task. We it appears to me that it might be an appropriate time to make a motion, and this might be a good springboard for further discussion. And I realize making a motion on this is a little bit daunting because there are so many recommendations in the SEC report. There are some modifications in the EMP report, and then there are some comments that Judge Jarre made that I think are important for us to incorporate in the motion as well. So I'd like to make a motion, and I'm mindful of the fact that it's an awfully broad motion, and I'm happy to withdraw it if fellow council members think that there's a more appropriate way to address the matter.
Could I just suggest that before a motion or separate motions be made, that we see if there's any other questions? Or, I mean, I have a couple questions that I'd like to pose, and then maybe motions would be more appropriate.
Judge Baker, are you done at this point?
Well, I'm I don't disagree with that process, but as I was mentioning, you know, it might be appropriate to hear a possible motion. It might affect some of the questions that are being asked.
I doubt it.
Well, let me just say this.
Questions are going to be asked.
Typically, the motion is made, and then we have discussion afterward. The motion doesn't cut off questioning. So if you want to put your motion out.
Well, again, I'm happy to withdraw the motion if fellow council members think this is a little bit too unwieldy. But this is what I was inclined to propose, that we adopt and direct the AD to implement the EMP recommendations set forth in Attachment 1, subject to the implementation schedule set forth therein, and subject to the modifications outlined by Judge Jarre in his presentation. So that's a proposed motion.
Okay. It's pretty broad.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a second by Justice Baxter. Now, discussion questions?
Yeah, I'm going to be very brief. I agree this is really a historic occasion. I wonder if the folks at Runnymede knew they were engaging in a historic occasion in those days, but I think we all do around this table. And thanks, obviously, to the chief who set all this in motion, but also thanks to literally hundreds of people, including hundreds of judges and jurists, who participated in this process. It's remarkable. I pretty much agree with not only the recommendations. I serve on ENP, but I also generally agree with the tweaks, if you will, management suggestions by Judge Jarre and Jody Patel, particularly as to OCCM. I think that's really an excellent approach. It's functional. It's viewed in a functional way rather than just boxes. Frankly, I think your proposal as to having the chief of staff be the number two is workable. At least we can try it, because there's no reason you can't make the COO number three, right? In other words, if both the ADOC and chief of staff are out doing their thing, well, number three is still there and can nothing wrong with being number three. But I do have two questions. Question number one is, there were a number of folks who raised issues regarding our commitment to diversity. And do you believe that any of these recommendations, including the adjustments that are suggested by Judge Jarre and Jody Patel, do you believe that any of these recommendations in any way diminish our commitment to diversity?
Judge, I don't believe so at all. These are structural changes, if you will, and we're not focusing with the structural changes on eliminating critical and important activities and projects that AOC is involved in. So I do not.
The only other question I have is with regard to the Office of Governmental Affairs. You know, there's different ways to slice this up, but it seems to me that the structure that you recommended for the new Legal Affairs Office, I think that's the title you gave it, is an appropriate structure also for the Office of Governmental Affairs. Plus, the beauty of it would make your chart a perfect mirror image. In other words, having a direct line to the Chief of Staff, but having that dotted line to the ADOC, just a thought, would that structure work for you?
I'm certainly not suggesting that it wouldn't. I believe that the proposal that I made would work better. And that's it in substance and effect.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we'll hear from Judge D'Alba, then Judge O'Malley.
Thank you, Chief. My comment is by suggestion to the Administrative Director, the Interim, and to Judge Jarre, in the spirit of managerial flexibility and periodic self-assessment, if you might consider taking the internal audit services portion of the finance division and break it away from a director or an office and make it more responsive or reportable to your office so that there be more independence to that audit unit for internal scrutiny and that periodic scrutiny that you spoke about. And again, that's just by way of suggestion. You might want to think about that, maybe come back in December, or whether you think that's good or bad or indifferent, however you feel. The other is just to thank my good friend, Brenda Harbin Forte, who came and made her comments. She is a tireless advocate for diversity. And, of course, to thank Ms. Cannon from the State Bar Council on access and fairness. And then just to say, as Judge Rosenberg mentioned, that with all of these structural changes to the Administrative Office of the Courts, that we make sure that we remain mindful of the Council's strategic goal number one of ensuring equal access and fairness and promoting diversity in the branch, that we not sacrifice programs or staff that are important to support those types of efforts. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Judge D'Alba. Judge O'Malley. First of all, Chief, I'd like to thank you for undertaking this very important step in changing the branch. I think that it's made judges across the state feel like you have opened up the doors for them, given them a voice. And also, I think it's given them confidence that this council will be... My noise here, sorry. What's with that?
I kind of like
that.
First time I've all...
People have been wanting to do that for a long time.
First time I've ever seen physical violence.
Here, I thought she was my friend.
Everybody's going on to sit next to you next time.
Judges across the state are just happy that you've just taken such a commanding role in, you know, how their voices are going to be heard, how this council is going to deal with the matters across the state as far as the AOC and other matters as to how this branch functions. So for that, I thank you. I really would like to thank Judge Walker and Judge McCabe and Judge Ellsworth, who have given so much of their time, as well as other members of the SEC, to really help you take that giant step towards giving us a new process in the future to look forward to and to go forward. I am thrilled that we have Judge Jarre, who is going to be taking the helm of the AOC. I think that he's of the right demeanor, knowledge, experience, intellect, to be able to handle very well all the duties that we are going to be placing in his trust. And I've heard, you know, some of the concerns by the SEC about, you know, Office of Legal Affairs or the and as well as OGA. I appreciate the concerns and the rationales that they've given. Everything in this report had absolutely rationale behind it 100% as far as why they had a recommendation, what it was based upon, and why they made the recommendation. I agree that it's probably stylistic, and I think if Judge Jarre is feeling that this is, you know, the way that he'd like to begin his journey, that we ought to afford him that opportunity and that discretion. And if he feels that he can handle, you know, Office of Governmental Affairs directly, and if he feels that Office of General Counsel should also report to the Chief of Staff as well as himself, then we ought to afford him that opportunity. And I have every confidence that if it's not working, they'll change it. That in the reports back that they're going to be giving to this council on a regular basis because of this report in the time, that we'll know whether or not it's working based upon those reports. And I'm just thrilled that we're here. I'm thrilled with the people that have been involved in this process. Justice Miller, you have taken this obligation from ENP, and you've just done it beautifully, gracefully, intelligently, and thoroughly, and thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Judge O'Malley. Commissioner Alexander.
I had a question again about the procedural fairness and public trust and confidence. I noticed that it's number 67 on the chart, and it says it's been completed, and part of that was because funding got eliminated. What I my question was is, how is the AOC, or where is those issues being addressed if there's no longer the procedural fairness and public trust and confidence program?
I'm going to have Chad address that. We had a discussion about this already.
Yeah. Hi. So on procedural fairness, at least, that falls within my division. And what we did, there was specific funding set aside for the big report that came out. I think it was about a year and a half ago now on procedural fairness. That was earmarked for that. And so that report came out, and it has been it was published. It's actually been – we've sent it to other states who have asked for it. So that we have one staff member who was sort of dedicated to that, and he now is working in the court interpreters program doing language access. So when we say the funding is completed, it was the funding for the specific procedural fairness report. So we still have the staff member who specializes in that, so that if a new report were needed at some point down the road or to update that, I think the council could choose to reallocate money for that, and then we still have the staff member with the expertise who could do the new report. So when we say that funding is no longer there, it's because we used up the funding that was previously allocated for that.
So that was a particular project.
It was. It was a big report. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Judge Jackson?
Well, one thing I'd like to emphasize, that there were some structural changes in some, I guess, departments or programs were eliminated, but it was our understanding at the EMP, and one of the judicial council oversights when we were talking about with our new ADOC, Jess Jar, is that when you try to institute a program, particularly dealing with diversity and, of course, fairness and access, that and whether to keep it or not to keep it, and I remember initially the SEC report talked about the financial or the business-like evaluation, but we also added at the EMP the impact on the stakeholders and our purpose. So that will always be a part of when you start to restructure and eliminate certain programs, where you will have to come back to the council, where we're going to review it, that not only the financial impact, but how does it affect us as a branch in ensuring diversity, fairness, and access. And I also like to thank the SEC, the members. I got to know them working at EMP. Justice Miller, it was a lot of fun, particularly on your birthday. We were going through 151 recommendations. And, of course, I'd like to thank our chief for initiating this whole process.
Thank you, Judge Jackson. Now we're going to hear from Kim Turner, Judge Jacobson, Judge Hardcastle.
Thank you, Chief. I wanted to echo the comments that were made by Judge D'Alba earlier, I'm pleased to see that others noticed that on the org chart, the fact that the internal audit services is, I believe, housed in the fiscal services program is probably not the ideal place to put a function of this nature. I think there are practical reasons and perception reasons to make sure that that internal audit division or internal audit unit, whatever we call it, is not reporting up through a number of steps of the chain of command steps of the organization to get to the administrative director of the courts, particularly if there's ever an opportunity for the internal audit group to be looking at any other AOC program or AOC division. So I think if you looked at the org charts of corporations and of other governmental entities, you would find that the internal audit services is typically has a direct line report to the administrative director or to some very high level position in the organization. And I think given these times, accountability, transparency, the criticisms that the branch has taken, that the AOC has taken, and that the council has taken, to highlight and to really, I think, perhaps memorialize a structural change here that will, I think, give more confidence to those who are looking at the AOC that internal audit is being given an opportunity to really bring findings and issues and concerns directly to the administrative director is a really good idea. It's a good idea for us, you know, in terms of the health of the organization going forward.
Judge, Chief, if I can just address that really quickly, and I appreciate your comments, Kim, as well as yours, Judge D'Alba. Judge Jarre and I have already had several discussions, not just about the internal audit unit, but other structural changes. We consider those phase two. Because in addition to the first two layers, if you will, as outlined by the SEC, we have been conducting our own internal org review that I've mentioned on a number of occasions just recently, and as a part of our own internal organization review, we wholeheartedly agree with and support what both of you have said.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Judge Jacobson, Judge Hardcastle, and Judge Kaufman.
Thank you, Chief. I just have two brief comments to make. One is, speaking from the perspective of someone who's worked in the criminal justice system for a long time, and having heard comments over a period of time and working on various projects, I'm aware that there is a perception across our branch in terms of in the local trial courts that the criminal side of our operations don't always get the same voice with the AOC or with the Judicial Council that perhaps other programs do. And I'm very pleased to see with the, and I'm speaking really to the proposed organizational restructuring, that the Office of Criminal Justice Services has been elevated. I want to say that as to the new incoming administration, Judge Jarre, Ms. Patel, that it gives me high hopes, but also great expectations in that regard. The other thing is, as we're all aware, we've been in a period in our branch of great divisiveness, and I want to particularly indicate that I very much appreciate the comments about perspective and the spirit with which we should go forward that were made by Justice Corrigan. Appreciate those very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Kaufman, then Miriam Krinsky.
Three things. As I said yesterday, is that from an organizational standpoint, we as a judicial council set policy, okay, and then we instruct the ADOC and his staff to implement the policy. And what we're doing now differently, in a sense, is that we have oversight, and they have to report back. As Justice Miller set out and he's been adamant about, is that every month we're going to get a report back. What we're designing today will be reviewed every month and reviewed annually. And I would hope that what we design today is flexible enough that a year from now, 5 years from now, the organization will change. It will change to meet the growing needs of this branch. That's what we need to be doing. But to micromanage the ADOC is not appropriate at this point, in my opinion. On the other hand, we have to have appropriate oversight of the ADOC to make sure that he and his staff are implementing what we're saying, number one. Number two is, no way should the AOC staff think that this is a demeaning exercise. They do a fantastic job. I've been PJ or APJ of a court for 14 years. I've been CJA president. I've been on the council twice now. I am so impressed with these people. They do a great job, and they deserve every accolade that we can give them. And in no way should this be looked at as a demeaning exercise. And then thirdly, as far as Judge Baker's motion, Justice Miller started out with basically three different areas of we should be adopting. And although I think it's obvious that we're going to approve this, I think it's important that we separate each area for adoption it's very clear to the branch and to everybody else and the stakeholders what we're doing. As far as that language, I leave it to other people, but I think you have to delineate everything.
And that's Judge Keck, so.
Okay, I understand that. Well taken, and I saw Judge So's hand go up. But Judge Hardcastle, you're next.
Thank you, Chief. I'm speaking this morning for CJA and for Judge Rubin, who's in Sacramento monitoring a vote that may be important to all of us. And if I get any updates from him, I'll let you know. But I would say kudos. My kids would give props to the authors of the SEC and as well to you, Chief, for starting this process when you first came on. And we thank you from CJA for including us in the process and for in the implementation And thanks to E&P and Justice Miller for including California Judges Association. We made an 18-page response or comment to the SEC report, and that was authored by our executive board. We stand by it. We ask that the council adopt the recommendations, and they be adopted as soon as practical and with all deliberate speed. As to the organizational chart and OGA, I just offer these personal observations. It's certainly more important as to what happens on the ground than what happens on an organizational chart. And Judge Jarre should be given the flexibility to make that work on the ground as well as on the chart. And to steal from the military a bit, since I spent 23 years in the Army, one of the processes might be to give command and control to the administrative director of OGA, but they'd be attached for administrative purposes to the chief of staff so that they could handle the day-to-day things and make sure that they work and play well with others and don't run with scissors or eat the paste. And then those day-to-day things, but the important things, as Justice Backer talked about, so that there can be that immediate pipeline that it go forward. And finally, I want to echo, if she's still here, Justice Corrigan's comments about, you know, we as judges, we're good at looking backward because that's what we do on the job. We look at what happened and try to figure it out. But now we have to start looking forward, and I really appreciated her comments. Thank you,
Judge Hardcastle. Next, we'll hear from Miriam Krinsky, then Judge Herman, Judge Yu. Thanks. I had three things simply to add, and I think that this has been a tremendous discussion. I'm actually intrigued that it was Justice Miller's birthday during many of the recommendations. I think it was probably a birthday where he aged 5 years rather than a single year. So it counted many times over. The first is in terms of the OGA issue. I think the sentiment around the table, and I think it's an appropriate sentiment, is that we've put the best person in place as the new ADOC. There's confidence in him. He needs to be allowed to do his job the way he best sees fit, with the council and leadership around this table keeping a watchful eye. And so I think, you know, everybody seems to be in agreement that if our new ADOC believes that this is the right structure, that should be given an opportunity to play out. To the extent there's a concern that it's too much on the ADOC, I think we've heard from him that he's comfortable with that, and I think we need to defer to that. To the extent the concern is perhaps that OGA won't be as much in the loop of the chief of staff knowing what's going on, I think we've heard from the chief and Jody that this is very much of a team approach, that there aren't silos among the executive team. I think if there were any change at all to be made, the only thing that I could envision is to put a dashed line between OGA and the chief of staff, just as the COO and the CAO have a dashed line to the chief of staff. But I don't frankly think that's necessary. I mean, it might add a little bit of that symmetry. Everybody sort of is connected. I'm not going to try to give it any shape or label, but I think that's the only change that in my mind would be appropriate thinking about, not that I think there needs to be a change. Second thing I wanted just briefly to comment on is the question, and Judge D'Alba and others have talked about this, of really making sure that there's no doubt in anybody's mind that equal access to justice and diversity remain a firm commitment of the Judicial Council, of this branch. And I know when the presentation was made about the SEC report, I think there were some concerns that were raised around this table. And I know that, you know, I referenced some worries that language in the SEC report or the focus of it not be misinterpreted to move away from those issues that in my mind are very much the core mission of this branch. I think there were concerns, and I think I was among those to raise them, that if your starting point is a business model where cost and business issues are the bottom line, that one can end up being viewed as moving away from it. So I appreciated the subtle changes that were made in recommendations 3 and 4, the reference to the benefit of the public
that hadn't previously been in there. And then I think in what's been renumbered by ENP as recommendation number four, that when we think about other projects, other initiatives, that front and center be a comprehensive analysis that would include a business case, issues of business case analysis, but that alone is not the driver. And to me, those signal a renewed commitment and an ongoing commitment to looking to do what's in the interest of the public, what's in the interest of the community that the branch serves. So in my mind, I think that has addressed those issues, although I also think it's going to be important for there to be a continued effort made through messaging and through other communication of what's happened today to make clear that remained front and center. And then the third thing that I wanted to say, I think a lot of credit, as is appropriate, Chief, has been given to you for your vision, for your efforts. And Justice Miller, you truly are amazing in how you've taken the Chief's vision and implemented it. But I really want to add to that, just as I did at the June meeting, a thanks and appreciation for the staff at AOC, as well as Jody, their leader through this time. It's not easy to face a report where you've been knocked around, where you're being asked to let go people, and to continue to stand tall and with professionalism move forward and redefine yourself and rethink what the future is going to look like. And I think whatever, you know, valid criticisms there may have been over time, I think that the last month in particular is an ongoing testament to the professionalism and the talent of those individuals who have continued to come in every day and try to focus their vision on the future and making this work. So I wanted to underscore that as well.
Thank you, Miriam. In the interests of time and what's been said here, I'm going to call the next four speakers and then call the question, mindful of the rest of our calendar, and that is Judge Herman, Judge Yu, Alan Carlson, and then Kenso.
I'm going to make substitute motion.
You can do whatever you want on your time. Mindful of the time. Okay.
You can make a substitute motion. I
just want to thank the Chief for the courage of leading us to commission both the SEC report and the Pegasus report to allow us to take a hard look at ourselves, and the courage of Justice Miller and ENP to, with wide open eyes, implement that courage and that hard look. And I know that we will go forward and follow these recommendations out to the timeline. I appreciate Judge Harbin Forte's comments as a former member of the Diversity Pipeline that recently published its report, and comments from the State Bar. These are important objectives. Access and fairness is number one. I think we should approach this as a Sarbanes-Oxley kind of split in terms of splitting the audit function from the actual budget function and finance function. I think that's important in terms of accountability. And finally, just to get back to the technology piece and 101, I really want to express my gratitude to the SEC committee, because I think that the idea that formulation of any new branch-wide technology policies or standards must be based on the input, needs, experiences of the courts, including cost-benefit analysis. I think that's those are important concepts that we actually are, I think, moving forward with at this time post CCMS. And the coda to that is the recent technology guidelines, which is that technology, an add-on, must not be a barrier to access to justice and fairness.
Thank you, Judge Herman. Judge Yu?
Thanks, Chief. I'll try not to lean on my cough button, and I'll try not to take too much time. Okay. I want to thank the speakers. Judge White was here yesterday, Justice Corrigan, people who affectionately know her as Judge Brenda, Ms. Cannon, and then people who are here from the State Bar, who are Pat Lee and Mary Flynn, as well as Emily Vasquez, a judge on the Superior Court in Sacramento, who was also part of the initial planning committee for the Diversity
summit on the bench in 2006, as well as the 529 people who posted comments and then those who emailed Judge Walkup, or I also received emails. I got to tell you, I have goosebumps. I mean, this is so cool, Chief. This is an open forum. This is exactly why my parents' families fled communism, so that we could have freedom of speech, democracy, dialogue, dissent. I mean, this is really cool. So thank you, Chief. And thank you, Justice Miller, because what I've perceived is this has really been a cooperative process. One of our judges in our state who commented among the 529 said he would advise us to approach this process with an aloha spirit. And that really stuck with me. I actually went and looked it up to make sure I understood what that meant. You know, it's approaching processes with love, with respect, with wisdom, with kindness, and you really have brought that to this process, Justice Miller. Everyone is, I think, feeling included, and that I perceive some healing as well. So thank you so much. Also, Chief, I would add to what Miriam said about the staff. You know, I've been here for 3 years. This is my last meeting. In those 3 years, staff and council have seen 2 chiefs and 4 ADOCs. That's a lot of change. There have been people who've been laid off, people who voluntarily left, you know, early to make room for others, people who have felt appreciated, people who have felt unappreciated. So the fact that, as Miriam said, they've always met every challenge with professionalism, grace, and a real commitment to service should not be overlooked. I did lean on my cough button. Sorry. With respect to, I'm so short, I can't reach the mic. But with respect to diversity, I think of it as really the lens through which we should see everything, the touchstone, diversity, access, fairness. Our structural changes are to the vehicle. We're changing the vehicle, so we're more streamlined, we're more, you know, energy efficient, we're dealing with the economic environment. But really, we are all going to the same place, which is service, keeping those courtroom doors open, making sure that the court looks like our community, and that we provide access and fairness to those who can afford it, and especially those who cannot afford it. So thank you so much, Chief. I feel like I'm leaving with a real sense of pride in our branch. And what I would say lastly is aloha, because it means hello and goodbye.
Thank you, Erica. Judge you in so many ways. Thank you. Helen Carlson.
Yes, thank you, Chief. And I endorse the comments about your courage and the hard work of the SEC folks and the ENP folks and everybody who comments. I'm going to pick up on what Justice Corgan says and go right to looking forward. So when we meet a year from now in the late fall of 2013 to review what happened during the last year, what are your metrics about this succeeded, this worked, we've accomplished, what we've done? And I know that's a tough question to start with, but and maybe we make that part of the recommendation or the motion. But I'd like to hear what your metrics are about what you think would be a sign of success and how we accomplish what you wanted to accomplish with this reorganization and the changes that are made here.
Well, actually, in some ways, I think the SEC report, which has now been reformulated by the Executive and Planning Committee into a structure, forms the template for those metrics. And it seems to me that it's not just the volume of things that we can report have been completed, but the scope that we've been able to accomplish. So I suppose I don't have an original thought in that regard, Alan, other than to say that we're duty-bound to do things deliberately, not destructively, in an organized way that is not something that will disturb the ongoing daily operations, and as Judge McCabe indicated, do so without jumping the gun, but by the same token, without dragging our feet.
Judge, so.
I have substitute motion. I have a series of substitute motions to break up the motion, essentially, of Judge Baker. There are three.
Point of order, Madam Chair. I heard Judge Baker say this was a proposed motion, so I don't know that he actually made the motion.
Well, It
was seconded.
So let's hear it.
All right. The first three deal with the executive and planning recommendations, which, of course, correspond to the SEC recommendations. As Justice Miller indicated, recommendations of ENP 2, 3, 4, and 5, if you would look in Attachment 1, correspond to SEC recommendations 4.1 through 4.4. And I think it's important to group those together because essentially it talks about the commitment and what the council needs to do in bringing this branch forward. And so I would move approval of executive and planning recommendations 2, 3, 4, and 5 first.
On behalf of Judge Wesley, I'll second that.
And so I'm going to call the question because I'm just going to say, I think then you're going to go to structure, and then you're going to go to the balance.
That's right.
Okay. So you know there's a roadmap. So, and seconded by Commissioner Alexander. And so, all in favor of the motion pertaining to ENP 2 through 5 to, regarding judicial council oversight that correspond through 4 through 1 through 4 through 4 through 4 1 through 4 4 of the SEC, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Matter passes. Okay.
All right.
Second.
The second deals with the organizational structure of the AOC and in exercising our oversight responsibilities. I'm making the motion that we approve the recommendation of Judge Jarr and Jody Patel as far as they've described it today for the organizational structure of the AOC.
Second. Second by Miriam Krinsky.
On behalf of myself, not Judge Wesley.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Matter carries. Third motion, Judge
Jones? And there's actually a fourth motion. I move approval of the remainder of the executive planning recommendations as set forth in Attachment 1.
Second by Justice Hall. Judge Baker?
No, I'm fine with that.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Matter carries.
And the fourth motion deals with Justice Hill's working group, and that's to move to include oversight of maintenance and management of court property and facilities to Justice Hill's working group.
I'll second that.
Thank you, Judge Jackson. All in favor?
although I appreciate that, it's actually Judge Powers working
Judge
group.
Powers working
the court
Thank you.
Modification and maintenance working group.
You thought it was.
I'm glad I stayed. That's all I can say.
Judge So takes that friendly amendment.
And I'll second.
And Judge Jackson seconds it. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're done.
Thank you. This is, in my view, a moment for the books. And so we will be anxious to hear report back and the involvement. Doug Miller, happy belated birthday. Kudos to you, ENP, SEC, 529 contributors, and the impassioned remarks and comments of counsel. Thank you. Okay.